corporate candy floss news and no political spin. This is Truth Radio by Internet. Thanks to our sponsor, NeemWell.com, because here, the expression is still free.
Close your eyes. Imagine you're going on a journey beyond sight and sound. A journey to a place far beyond the realms of all known consciousness. Welcome.
It's Monday, the 30th of May, and we're still in what amounts to a virtual media blackout on the details of what's happening in Iraq right now. But we're about to change that tonight. Stay tuned for Dar Jamail with a full update on latest developments in Iraq. This is Truth Radio on BreakForNews.com.
Would you do me a favor and push me on to the next level?
And this is Fintan Dunn reporting. Thank you very much for joining us. And thanks also to our sponsor, NeemWell.com, your personal source for potent Indian neem. Check it out, NeemWell.com. Thanks to NeemWell for making this possible. Tonight, we are going to be joined by Dar Jamail. He's been on the show before with live reports from Baghdad. And of course, he was back in the United States recently on a speaking tour recounting his experiences in Iraq. And almost against his own better judgment, he's found himself committed to returning to the region. And by the way, you can get to a list of Dar's recent articles from Iraq and other writings. Just click on Dar's name right beside where you clicked for this audio, or darjamailiraq.com. Well, we're glad Dar Jamail is back in the area because there's a surprising lack of media coverage about what's going on. After all, by the end of this month, May, we'll see well in excess of 700 Iraqis will have lost their lives and certainly over 60 US troops, as the situation, even from this distance, appears to be deteriorating by the day. Now the US is on a new military offensive in the Baghdad area. And for details of that and more, Dar Jamail is joining us on the line right now from Amman in Jordan. You're very welcome again, Dar, to BreakForNews.com. And Dar, even as the US rolls out this new security operation in Baghdad, it's been total mayhem over the weekend there.
That is correct. They are detaining very large numbers of people now as they move through each sector of the city with their new operation. Just yesterday, in one of the districts of Baghdad, there were very, very fierce clashes. At least three Humvees, American Humvees, were destroyed, and many Iraqi troops were wounded. And I would expect that sort of thing to continue as this operation continues.
Okay, well, we're not getting those reports yet coming out of official U.S. military sources, but certainly there was intense fighting in western Baghdad yesterday and over the weekend.
Yes, very much so. And I should also add that there has been renewed fighting inside Fallujah even. Just a few nights ago, there was clashes. 18 people were wounded there, and from time to time, roadside bombs are being detonated inside that city as well.
Okay, well, we have official news media reports, just to give people a flavor of what's going down in Baghdad right now, that 50 insurgents, so-called, stormed a checkpoint, killing 9 Iraqi troops. Shortly after dawn in Madain in south Baghdad, there was another attack killing a policeman and a civilian. 3 hours later, 2 Iraqi commandos were killed in a car bomb in the same neighborhood. Around 1:30, suicide bomber went through the outer security barriers at the Iraqi oil ministry, killing 2 guards and injuring 6 bystanders. Later at 4 p.m., a car bomb killed 3 more Iraqi policemen. And in the Dora section, gunmen killed 2 police sergeants. And then near sunset, a suicide bomb hit an Iraqi patrol, killing 2 policemen. And that's probably not all the incidents.
Yes, I think what we're seeing is the standard procedure that occurs every time a large U.S.-backed operation commences. And even though this one has much more of an Iraqi face on it than most in the past. It should be made clear that this security ring and this whole operation is essentially constructed and backed by the U.S. military. There are a very large number of U.S. soldiers involved in this operation. And what we're seeing already, just with the list that you just went down of the mayhem and bloodshed happening as a result of this, just like all the other major military operations the U.S. launches in Iraq, we see the fighting starting to spring up elsewhere. The resistance fighters inside of Baghdad had noticed this was coming. They do have very good intelligence and have since made their way out of the city so they could launch attacks elsewhere, as we're seeing right now.
Yeah, well, there was a strategic hope by U.S. planners that it would drive them out of Baghdad, but it looks like a significant resistance force is still prepared to take on U.S. forces and Iraqi forces in Baghdad.
Well, without a doubt, and really, Baghdad is a very huge, sprawling capital city, 5.5 million people. So even with 40,000 Iraqi troops and a large number of U.S. soldiers, it's really still a dismally small number if we really look at the task they're attempting to undertake. And they're attempting to use Baghdad as a sort of model and then apply the same plan to other cities around Iraq that need this sort of thing in their idea of rooting out the resistance fighters. And really, it's an impossible task. If we look even at Fallujah, where they bombed 60% of the city almost to the ground, devastated the city, and did for at least a time being have control of the city, they've already lost parts of control of parts of that city even today. So that doesn't really bode well for this plan of attack on Baghdad. And it's very troublesome also because the other aspect of the majority of these Iraqi National Guard working with the U.S. military, they're either members of the Shia Badr militia or the Kurdish Peshmerga militia. And so it could easily be argued that this is already the beginnings of sort of a U.S.-sparked civil war because the resistance, being primarily Sunni at this point, is battling now other Shia militias, but it looks a bit more fancy on paper, if you will, because it is being posed as this large military operation backed by the Iraqi government. But people have to remember that the Iraqi government is essentially controlled by the Shia first and then the Kurds second. So that is essentially what we're seeing, and I think the ramifications of this could be very dire indeed.
Well, yeah, just taking a look at that issue, there were moves over the weekend to head off sectarian tensions when the Badr Brigade Muqtada al-Sadr met with the Muslim scholars. There were reports of a favorable outcome to that meeting. How do you gauge how this is likely to play out at a political level between the Sunni and Shia?
Well, it is very complex, of course, as you well know, and what we keep seeing playing out is that, of course, the majority of people, the average Iraqi, does not want a civil war. They're very afraid of it. They will do anything in their power to avoid it. But as again, and we see some of the political leaders and religious leaders working very hard to avert this disastrous situation. But then again, we have other political leaders who, people like Jafari and Talabani and people, high-ranking people in the Iraqi government backed by the U.S., along with the U.S. military there, continue to make these moves that are undermining the efforts being made by other religious and political leaders to avert civil war. And hopefully this is something that will not happen. It would be an absolute disaster, but so many people I've spoken with inside of Iraq believe that it is intentional even that the U.S. wants some sort of a civil war there to have continuing chaos and bloodshed to justify an ongoing military presence in the country.
It is complex, as you say, and hopefully we'll address some of those complexities. For example, whatever the legitimacy of the so-called Iraqi government, the forces, both police and pseudo-military, that are acting on their behalf are a pretty ratbag lot. And you've written about how they've been involved in incidents involving looting, and they are feared by the Iraqi people as a gang of maniacs, even as they drive through the streets there.
They are, very much so. Many of them, I've been told by so many different Iraqis, are actually criminals, keeping in mind that one of the last things Saddam Hussein did while he was still in power before the invasion was he emptied all of the jails in Iraq. And people, time and time again, I've had Iraqis come to me and say, yes, We know that so many of these people are actually criminals. I've seen them looting people. I've seen police rob people. I personally have had one of my journalist colleagues robbed by Iraqi police. So just to give you an idea of what a large contingent of these people are their backgrounds, it's really quite frightening. They behave very badly. Another incident I should point out, several of my Iraqi doctor friends told me, and one in particular that was working at Yarmouk Hospital at the time it happened, a couple of months ago, some Iraqi National Guard troops were injured. They brought them to Yarmouk Hospital, and for whatever reason, they weren't happy with the treatment or did not want to have to wait their turn in line, but they started beating. So they severely beat four Iraqi doctors. So all of the doctors in the hospitals across Baghdad went on strike that day to protest. People are very upset with the behavior of these Iraqi National Guard and oftentimes the Iraqi police. And, of course, something now, which we see a line of 40,000 of them encircling Baghdad and going neighborhood to neighborhood, people are not happy about it whatsoever.
Well, yeah, it smacks of desperation, Dar. Paul Craig Roberts, writing on antiwar.com today, says, what are we to make of all this? It seems as if the extermination of the Sunnis will be required if the U.S. is to achieve victory in Iraq. So are they about to go for the final option, which is to turn Baghdad into a war zone?
Well, that is essentially what they are doing, and obviously their planners feel that that is what is necessary, as drastic as it might be, to try to do something to end this resistance, because it consistently, the resistance that is just consistently over time getting more and more organized, better intelligence, more powerful and more lethal. They're getting better weapons. They have no problem with funding coming in. They continue to get an increasing number of troops. But once again, I really think what we're going to see, rather than this really dampening the resistance, we're going to see a backfiring, as we've seen with every other military operation launched, whether it be either Siege of Fallujah or Al-Qaim or what's happened more recently in Haditha, where they go in, civilians are being killed, therefore drawing more families into supporting the resistance. And then every time they detain someone, this is again drawing more people into the resistance, because everyone in Iraq is well aware of what happens when people go to prison. And then another thing that should be pointed out that is also a huge recruitment tool is the massive numbers of detainees. I'm actually currently working on a story. I just finished interviewing many Iraqis here, some of them doctors, one man in charge of a human rights organization inside Fallujah, and all of them estimate that even though the U.S. military admits that there are 17,000 detained Iraqis that they have names and numbers for, that actually the real number is well over 60,000. So these are missing persons. Essentially, they've been disappeared within their own country. Their families don't know where they are, where they're being held, what the charges are, and this is infuriating people. And then all of these families are, some of them, angry enough to pick up arms.
Okay, let's just take a break for a moment, and we'll be right back. This is Truth Radio on BreakForNews.com.
To the other side, where many people learn to live with their handicaps while the others die. Where motherfuckers had no money spots, and if they did, then they ass went insane when all the money stopped. I'm from the ghetto, so I'm used to that. Look on your motherfucking map and find Texas and see where Houston at. It's on the borderline of hard times, and it's seldom that you hear niggas praying and giving God time. That's why I ask my mind to pray for me, because I know that even I got to die, and he got a day for me. And every morning I wake up, I'm kinda glad to be alive, cause thousands of my homeboys died, and very few died of old age. In most cases, the incident covered up the whole page, from Amsterdam to Amarillo. It ain't no secret, the world is a ghetto.
100 niggas died in guerrilla warfare in a village in Africa, but did nobody care? They just called up the goddamn grave digger and said, come get these motherfucking niggas. Just like they do in the Fifth Ward, in the South Park, in the Bronx, in the Watts. You know they got crooked cops working for the system, making poor motherfuckers out of victims. Cause don't nobody give a fuck about the poor. It's double jeopardy if you're black or Latino. They got their motherfucking drugs in the slums, got us killing one another over crumbs. Think I'm lying? Well, motherfucker, I got proof. Name a section in your city where minorities grew, and I'ma show you prostitutes, dope, and hard times, and a murder rate that never declines, and little babies sitting on the porch smelling smelly, crying cause they ain't got food in their bellies. They call my neighborhood a jungle, and me an animal, like they do the people of Rwanda. Fools fleeing their countries to come here black, but see the same bullshit and head right back. They find out what niggas already know.
And you're very welcome back. This is Truth Radio, and we're speaking with Dar Jamail. Dar, you know, some of the stuff that isn't coming out in the Western media are severely downplayed. Iraqi resistance shot dead the commander of a new counterinsurgency headquarters, which had been set up by the Iraqi government on his way to work. That's Major General Wael Rubai. And that really wasn't very well reported in Western media, but that gives you an idea how flimsy this security effort is if it can't protect the counterinsurgency operations headquarters chief himself.
Yes, very much so. And you made a very good point earlier talking about this new security operation in Baghdad with the 40,000 troops, of it being more of an act of desperation. And I really want to underscore that fact because it does tie into, like you said, we have high-ranking commanders in this Iraqi security force being assassinated on a daily basis. We have police chiefs being assassinated on a daily basis. Needless to say, the ground troops, whether they be police or soldiers themselves. And just to give you an idea of how desperate the U.S. military and the Bush administration has been to try to bring Iraqis into their security forces to try to assist inside their own country, the average training day for an Iraqi policeman is 18 days. That against, I know back in America, for example, police academies for officers there run anywhere from 3 to 6 months. So these people, many of them with no training whatsoever, are basically run through an 18-day crash course and thrown out into the streets of what is definitely the most dangerous capital city on the planet, and working alongside a U.S. military that is very, very much a target, very trigger-happy, very afraid themselves. So it is a desperate situation, as evidenced by the daily attacks, which are on average now over 50 attacks a day on U.S. soldiers alone. We don't know how many attacks are being launched on Iraqi security forces, but it's very safe to say that it is immensely higher than 50 per day, along with these ongoing assassinations.
Right, right. And of course, in the middle of all this are Iraqi civilians who are bearing the cost of it as well, at least 700 since the so-called declaration of the new government.
It really is, and that's just in this month alone, and this month is not over yet, even though it is close to being over. It's astonishing, and that's really the most horrific fact of this entire situation, is that from day one of the occupation, it has been the Iraqi civilians who are paying the dearest price for all of the violence in the country and the instability caused by this horribly failed U.S.-led occupation of the country. Because under international law, of course, the primary responsibility of occupation forces is to safeguard the citizens of the country. And in that regard, the U.S. military, even mentioning those two ideas in the same breath is a bit of a farce, because they can't even protect themselves, let alone Iraqi civilians. And now the sad fact is that on any given day, I can't remember the last day where there's been under 10 Iraqi civilians killed, and not just in this month, but it really is horrific. And we're going to have an updated figure at some point besides the Lancet report, which is now many months out of date, which stated that at least 100,000 Iraqi civilians had died thus far.
Well, yeah, this battle seems to be proceeding without the kind of constraints that you'd expect a modern Western democracy to be under. Humanitarian constraints in terms of how they pursue things. they're pursuing it just as if this was Vietnam, Dar. You know, so they can use slash and burn tactics, and they're prepared to use it on Baghdad right now.
Well, that is exactly what they've been doing. For example, with Fallujah, it was very much slash and burn, and we see this same model applied up near Al-Qaim, where we've had hospitals destroyed, so many civilian homes destroyed, and similar tactics being used in Haditha, and then now, very frighteningly, appears to be what will occur in Baghdad. Just the other week, we had U.S. helicopters firing rockets into homes and mosques in separate parts of Baghdad, and I would expect to see that sort of tactic being used as this current operation commences.
Well, then you're talking about fighting a guerrilla war right in the middle of a civilian population. Well, you know, the implications of that for Baghdad are not pleasant. Let's take a look at Fallujah. How is that getting on there, Dar? Because, after all, having liberated the city, now we're in the process of rebuilding a new modern Iraq there. Is that right, Dar?
Well, that is certainly what the Bush administration and the mainstream media in America would like people to believe, that Fallujah was liberated, the people are better off now, they're happy, and the U.S. reconstruction companies and the U.S. military are working alongside Iraqis to rebuild their city. The reality on the ground, and I have this information straight from making phone calls into contacts inside Fallujah, made several phone calls yesterday, as well as interviewing doctors who'd been working inside of Fallujah, I've interviewed very recently, as well as the head of a human rights, human rights organization working inside Fallujah, and all of them are telling a very, very dismal story. That, for example, let's just start with security, that while U.S. forces and Iraqi forces continue to patrol the city, even just 3 days ago, there were some quite fierce clashes in the middle of the city with 18 people wounded. Now roadside bombs are being detonated once again inside the city, and the U.S. military is struggling to maintain control once again over certain districts inside the city. And as far as infrastructure, it remains in shambles. In the districts that even have electricity, they are having 2 hours of electricity and then 6 hours cut. There are at least right now two full neighborhoods inside of Fallujah with absolutely zero electricity. The doctors I spoke with, as well as the human rights workers, said that there is no potable water inside Fallujah, that they have instructed everyone to boil their water for at least 10 minutes. Of course, there's no jobs. And any rebuilding that is occurring is being done by Fallujahans themselves. And as far as compensation, this is yet another in a long list of horrible, disastrous moves that the U.S. military has made. They promised the people they would pay approximately $600 million to help them begin to rebuild their homes and buildings that were damaged during the siege. Mm-hmm. And as of right now, according to all my Iraqi contacts, only 10% of those funds have been paid out, and it doesn't look like the rest is going to come. So as one of the Iraqis I spoke with said, the military would have been better off not paying anything, because now all they've done is greatly insulted and infuriated residents within the city.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, some of the attitudinal issues, Dar, that have played into this, let me speak frankly, we're in the aftermath of what was, by any modern standards, a war crime. There's no excusing what has gone on. But in support of that, you have recently in the London Times an article by Richard Beeston, where he's talking about Fallujahans as if they were violent psychiatric patients who had just been given a lobotomy. He actually said the lobotomy has been a success. This is an extraordinarily racist kind of propaganda which is appearing in Western media and seems to have successfully dehumanized Fallujahans.
That is absolutely one of the most disturbing articles I've seen in a long, long time. I'm almost at a loss of words to reply to that. It is one of the most racist, hate-filled, ignorant things that someone could possibly say about this situation. And along the same lines, a very disturbing trend, a similar trend is happening in U.S. media. On Fox News recently, people there were talking, basically doing the same dehumanization tactics against Iraqis as a whole, blaming them for the instability in their country, blaming them for the fact that there's no reconstruction. Playing blame the victim game, it is rather frightening, especially keeping in context. Contrast that with the propaganda put out by the Bush administration and the corporate media in the U.S. saying, yes, we're going to come help Iraqis, we're going to liberate them. And now 2 years later, they're having to demonize these people that supposedly they were going to come be the saviors of.
And how is it playing there in Amman, in Jordan, at the moment? Because I know there's a tremendous Iraqi expatriate population. How are they reacting to latest developments coming out of Iraq now?
Well, of course, people here, whether they be displaced Iraqis or Iraqi expatriates or Jordanians themselves, are very distraught at the news. The vast majority of people here are staunchly opposed to the occupation, as they were extremely opposed to the invasion itself. So people are very distressed with the news. They're very angry because people who have come out here, I've interviewed so many Iraqis who have come out either because the security is so bad or for economic reasons, because there continues to be well over 60% unemployment inside of Iraq. So as this horrible news continues to emerge from the rubble of Iraq and the news continues to worsen, people are very upset about it and really just don't know what to do at this point.
Dara, just taking a look at some of the personal side, because there are personal issues for ordinary individual Iraqis that get lost. But I'd like to start with your personal feelings, because you wrote about those prior to heading back. I can empathize with what you were writing about. It's funny being in a Western society, seeing all the benefits of Western society around you and knowing that this other stuff is going on, and it's going on in your own mind all the time, I'm sure.
Yes, it is very distressing, particularly being an American myself, and the time I was back in the U.S. before I returned to the Middle East, I was there for about 10 weeks, most of the time spent doing presentations about what I've been seeing in Iraq. And the disparity, it's really irreconcilable, knowing that I am reporting on this horrific situation, which to me is, with every passing day, becoming more and more of just a massacre, more and more closely resembling Vietnam, and being completely caused 100% by the U.S. government, by the U.S. military, in this illegal occupation, after this illegal invasion, and it's just irreconcilable to me. I go home, I've seen how horrible it is inside of Iraq, and even in America, in the anti-war movement themselves, people really just don't quite grasp, they can't grasp how horrible it is, and it's frustrating for me to go home and not see tens of hundreds of thousands of people out on the streets demanding an end to this every single day, taking more risks to force the government, to pressure the government to change this policy, to immediately begin to withdraw from Iraq. Why are we not seeing this happening in the U.S.? How much longer will it take before we have something like the anti-war movement that ended up becoming quite effective during the Vietnam era? And it's frightening to me to think that it might take even another 6 months, year, or possibly 2 or 3 years before it reaches the proportions necessary to start to affect some change. And so to go home and really see so many people just going on with their lives, all of their needs are taken care of. They have electricity, they have security, they have jobs, they have plenty of what they need. And living in this environment, meanwhile, their government and their military is perpetuating some of the most horrific things imaginable.
Yeah, you know, it's a contrast between, and what you're talking about there is really what the veteran feels who comes back from a conflict zone, to see life going on apparently normally all around, and at the same time they know that this other mayhem is continuing unremarked by the people around them, where the most important decision is, will I have time to make it down to Denny's and still catch that meeting, rather than where am I going to get water today, and I wonder what's happened to our sister, and I wonder what's happened to our uncle who is detained.
I keep very close contact with my friends in Iraq, with my interpreter, and it's moved from the point where people, not long ago, it was, of course, very risky for people to go out of their homes, and they said, yes, we're not even safe in our own streets. And then now, especially with this new operation in Baghdad, one of my friends wrote me just this morning, actually, in an email and said, now we're not even safe in our own homes. It's gotten to that point inside of Iraq. It is that bad. It is going to continue to get worse. And it's really irreconcilable that this is going on. Meanwhile, people back home are just going about their lives as if everything's okay.
And it's going to be a bit late, to be quite frank. It's going to be a bit late when the troops come back, because I think they're coming back one way or the other in the end. And when they come back and they are going to be psychiatrically affected, taking up the tone of that scurrilous article in the London Times, as are Iraqis being psychologically affected. The psychological scars of what's going on right now, ignored, are going to plague both Iraq and the United States of America for the next 25 years.
And that's another very solid parallel with Vietnam, where there are certain sectors of the population of America who still have yet to really fully recover from that conflict. And now this could essentially even be worse, in that maybe the U.S. won't suffer such a huge casualty count of dead, but with wounded, it's already tens of thousands of wounded soldiers coming back. And when I say wounded, I mean not just a broken arm or a scrape, but permanently disabled. Many people are coming back brain dead now, many soldiers, because when an improvised explosive device goes off, a roadside bomb goes off near a Humvee, I've seen photos of soldiers who their helmets will be blown off their heads, but by the concussion of the blast, and they won't have any physical wounds, but it has jarred their brain enough that they are coming back essentially brain dead. And this is now one of the more common injuries coming out of Iraq. And then to talk about the Iraqi civilians, we already see huge increases in cure rates from all the depleted uranium munitions being used throughout the country. So many wounded people, and psychologically indeed. So you can only imagine what young children have to deal with growing up in this environment, what parents have to deal with, wondering every day, is something going to happen to me? Is something going to happen to my child if I allow my child to even go to school? And this is the daily life now for Iraqis.
Let's just continue in a moment. We'll take another quick break. I'm with Dar Jamail. This is Truth Radio on breakfornews.com, and we'll be right back. And you're very welcome back. This is Truth Radio on breakfornews.com, and I'm speaking to Dar Jamail. For the US troops who are over there, many of them, they're in a situation where they were not psychologically prepared, I don't think, for what they were going into, where they were in many cases reserve troops who didn't expect to be facing combat, and they're going to take that scarring and that psychological difficulty back to their extended families. We're not going to walk away from this one. Already a huge price has been paid unremarked.
We have well over 6,000 soldiers who have deserted. We have people coming home very upset, refusing to go back. And I've spoken with several soldiers myself who said, yes, we were told we are going over to help the Iraqi people. We were told this was very important for national security. But when we got over there, we saw that all of the reasons given to us to go were flat-out lies, that this our job in Iraq has nothing to do with helping Iraqis, nothing to do with providing security for them. Heck, we can't even provide security for ourselves. And it's very clear to us, especially in Iraq, that this situation has nothing to do with national security for the United States, because Iraq, of course, has no weapons of mass destruction, did not have any links with what occurred in the U.S. on 9/11. So all of the reasons given were simply false. And so many soldiers have told me, yes, we were lied to, betrayed, for me to be sent into this situation by my government, who it is my duty to follow their orders. But those orders are supposed to be taken with my welfare in mind, and only going to war as a last possible resort. And when they get to Iraq, they see that this whole situation was wrong. We should not be there. There were other methods to deal with this situation rather than invading and occupying the country. And then they're in this horrific situation. It's a very brutal guerrilla war. They can be attacked at any time by anyone. Most of the U.S. bases in Iraq are being mortared every single day. We have people coming home now suffering effects from depleted uranium, psychological scarring, and coming home and having very difficult times with their families, even when they're just on leave. Many families disintegrating under the weight of this occupation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, looking at the reasons why, as you wrote, why the streets aren't filled with people every single day, it's down to the media. Well, there's a lot of responsibility being borne by different political elements as well. But there's no way they're even getting close to touching the top of this iceberg. You know, sporadic reports about troops getting prosthetic limbs fitted. And that's about it, Dar. It's pathetic.
Yes, you're exactly right. And I think that is really the primary reason why more people aren't really up in arms over what is occurring. Because, again, contrasting the media coverage of Iraq with Vietnam. In Vietnam, every day we had body counts, every day we had footage and photographs coming out of horrific things happening in Vietnam. We had far better journalism, at least in the U.S., over what was happening then, even though it was even biased and tainted to an extent then. But it was really head and shoulders above what we're seeing now, which, as it continues to worsen, unfortunately, the threshold now of what makes the news keeps getting higher and higher. So unless it's a horrifically bloody day in Iraq where we have 100 dead Iraqis or, say, 10 dead U.S. soldiers, it's really just a passing thought in most of the media in the U.S. And so they are certainly complicit in allowing the situation, A, to happen in the first place, and B, to continue on. And I think when people in the U.S. do begin to wake up to how bad it truly is, they will see the extent to which the media itself has gone to not only hide but mislead people about how horrible the situation is, what the ramifications will be, and the true cost of this occupation on the Iraqi people and U.S. soldiers and U.S. citizens themselves.
And I can't help but feel that at some point when this madness is over, and I hope it's soon, that certain key figures in the media are going to find themselves sitting before some kind of truth commission and explaining their role in the incitement to commit atrocity, in the facilitation of atrocity. We're reading total propaganda bullshit that is reminiscent of World War II, far worse than the reporting standards of Vietnam, and the implications of that for what's going to happen to Americans before everyone gets a grip, they're dire implications.
Well, that's a very important point. I, in fact, attended a World Tribunal on Iraq in Rome, Italy, in February, focused specifically on media complicity in the situation. And what this tribunal did, the conclusions reached, were that the mainstream media in America and throughout much of the West itself, but primarily in America, were guilty of violating the Nuremberg Charter for Journalism, which states that one of the primary responsibilities of the media in a time of war is not to incite people to violence, which is exactly what media, mainstream media in the U.S. did by helping assist the Bush administration by invading Iraq and selling it to the American people. They are certainly guilty of violating the Nuremberg Charter of Journalism, as well as the UNESCO Charter for Journalism, which states the same as the Nuremberg Charter. And hopefully at some point, and the Nuremberg Charter, of course, was written up because of what happened during World War II with Nazi Germany. And I really hope and want to believe that someday key media figures will be brought to justice and held to account for what they've done, because certainly this whole situation could not have happened in the first place and would not be ongoing right now if it weren't for the media continuing to do not just a horrible job of reporting it, but continuing to deliberately mislead people and misrepresent the atrocious situation on the ground in Iraq today.
Well, you know, frankly speaking, have you had that phone rung off your ear with media from the West getting in touch with you to get what's the story on Iraq?
That's a good point to bring up, because I came to Iraq simply out of frustration. I had only a little bit of journalistic experience, and I came to report because I saw the horrible job being done by mainstream media in the U.S., and I hope that being able to put my two cents into the mix would alleviate at least a little bit of that. But the great irony is most of the larger media outlets that I report for are not even in America. Mainstream media outlets in America won't touch my reporting, whether it be my writing or radio. Ironically, I've even reported on BBC Radio at times, and numerous other large media outlets around the globe, and as well as writing now more for larger outlets in different countries, but not in America. My outlets in America continue to be alternative media. There is quite a media blackout in the States. I have even sent stories asking, don't pay me, just even send one of your own reporters to cover this. But, for example, with the torturing, I broke a story on torture that was broke 4 months before the Abu Ghraib scandal occurred. I sent it to all the major outlets, and no one even touched it. And that's the extent of the media blackout that is happening in the U.S. regarding the situation.
Okay, well, even in the alternative media, I could run off a half a dozen names, which I won't, because I'm not going to single out particular media outlets, who should have already been onto you. And you should be saying to me, look, I don't have time to talk to you, Fintan, because, you know, you've got to take your place in the queue behind BBC Two and Democracy Now! And everybody else who's on to me. And I'm getting the impression from what you're saying is that they're not interested.
Well, I wouldn't say no interest. I do report for Democracy Now! From time to time, but it is quite small by comparison of what's happening in Iraq on a daily basis. And you're very right. My phone, in my opinion, should be ringing off the hook as far as getting better sourced information out to people that I have available to me, that I'm willing to report that the mainstream media overall simply aren't doing. And it is very troublesome, and you do make a good point, because I think media outlets, alternative media outlets in the U.S. even, could be doing a better job and continuing to devote their coverage to Iraq primarily on a daily basis, especially because the mainstream media won't be doing it, and we're just not seeing that happen.
And so here you are talking to Break for News. Break for who? Who's the best-known worldwide, international, independent reporter in Iraq right now? And he's talking to Break for who? Never heard of him. Well, there you go. We're certainly still interested in getting your updated reports on the situation there, Dar. And thank you very much for joining us today, and take care of yourself.
Thank you very much again for having me, Fintan.
And I'd like to thank on your behalf, I'm sure, Dar, for joining us tonight with that very informative report. Among the many things that Dar covered there for us, the most startling, I felt, that figure of 60,000 Iraqis now detained by US forces in what amount to giant concentration camps. It's not a pretty picture, is it? Dar's website again is darjamailiraq.com. You can support his valuable work there by donating, and of course on breakfornews.com just click on the subscriber link and you can become a charter subscriber of Break for News and help the work we're doing here also. Can I say thank you to those who have responded to our recent funding appeal, and urge those of you who haven't to do so. Thank you indeed. Now, we don't have the resources for a commercial server for these audio files, and we're having currently problems with the server that we're using, so please bear with us on that until we can get that resolved. Okay, that's it for tonight. I will be back soon with more Truth Radio on breakfornews.com. I hope you can join me for that. But in the meantime, for breakfornews.com, this has been Fintan Dunn reporting.
In a world full of people, only someone to find, isn't that crazy? There's a